Have you ever had the question posed to you, why don't y'all believe in music? I've had that on more than one occasion, and it's always interesting when I get that because it gives me the opportunity to explain, well, I'm a firm believer in music. But of course, the idea is that why don't you use any kind of instrumental music along with your singing? Sometimes it gets sharper than that. Many years ago now, I remember I left a morning worship and got in the car, turned on the radio, and there was a preacher preaching on this topic. And he said, for those who do not believe in instrumental music, it is the height of arrogance and the depths of stupidity. And I thought, man, that's convincing. I've changed my mind, right? No, I mean, that didn't work either. Name calling, insulting never does. In our more modern, postmodern times, more of now you're going to hear, I get you, that's your tradition. And if you like that tradition, it's fine, and I've got mine. All of those ideas miss the point, don't they? Yet, when someone questions you about not using instruments of music, typically it's the idea of this is such a foreign concept. Or this is such a little thing that you're making into a really big deal. So this morning, wherever you come down on this idea, I want you to understand, if we relegate it to that, what we are saying in effect is worship to God and how we do it is not a very big deal. And I don't know that anyone who would take that view legitimately would ever say, I don't think worshiping God is a big deal. So, if it is a big deal, what we must do is figure out what God desires. So this morning, I want to share just a few thoughts with you. And regardless of where you stand on this matter, I just ask that you take what I say, put it to reason, and I also ask you to consider it in light of a discussion that we started last week. And that is approaching the authority of the Bible with the idea of being a primitivist. And just by very quick summary of that, all that means is that we are looking for plain old Christians in the first century and we're seeing how they did things. And if it's approved by either direct statement or approved example, we're going to say, well, that's what I need to do also. That's the kind of service, that's the kind of worship, that's the kind of attitude that I want to take. So with that in mind, let's approach this idea of how to worship God in song. Before we get into the specifics of this, let's look at the big picture of worship. There's some things we got to understand. And one of those, very importantly, is this, that no matter when you live, whether you were Adam in the Garden of Eden, whether you were Abraham leaving your homeland, whether you were the first century Christians, whether you are a 21st century Christian, no matter the time, worship is always important. That is a statement of understanding the relationship between God and humanity. The greater is deserving of worship. And so, if you are a child of God, whenever, wherever, worship has always and is always a really, really big deal. Okay, that's a premise we've got to start with in this discussion. Second thing we need to understand is, when we look to the New Testament, it's going to establish that idea. We look at Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28. Let's read it, and then I'll tell you why I picked out this particular verse. The Hebrew writer says, therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. The reason I chose this is because the writer is picking out some key terms from the Old Testament. The idea of awe in particular is one that we find being used all along with God. And so our writer here is saying worship's a big deal. Worship is something you need to understand as an important way of giving God the glory, of showing that He is the awesome God. All right, so point number one. No matter when you live, worship's important. Point number two, no matter the era, there are certain things that are always going to be the case. whether you are Adam, Abraham, first century Christians, or us, whenever, wherever, certain things are always universal. One of those is, it's always directed toward God. You remember in Revelation when John bows down before the angel and the angel says, you worship God, right? We worship God alone. We look back to the Old Testament and we find whenever the people of Israel would begin going off toward idols, God would correct them. Or if he was talking about the pagans that had given themselves over to idols, God would correct them. He's the only one who gets worship, no matter the time that you live. And worship always flows from the heart. I don't know that the people of God have always understood this point. Sometimes you hear this very erroneous view that, well, in the Old Testament, it was all outward. It was an outward show, but in the New Testament, we're talking about the inward. That is not true. In fact, when the Lord is talking about worship being given in vain, he's going to pick up and quote from a section of Isaiah about such things. God has never wanted a people who are giving him half-hearted, only lip service. It's never ritualistic in the sense that you don't have to put any thought into it. So, we understand that no matter the era, God desires worship from the heart. And what we find is that no matter the era, the worship is always in praise to God and helping others to praise God. We think about a lot of the hymns recorded in the Old Testament. They were all about events of great magnitude where God is saying, I want you to remember what I did and to teach it to others in song. So long before you had a lot of history books written down, you'd put a big event to music. You'd teach people how to sing it, teach them the song, and they would pass it on. So no matter the era, these things are always going to be essential if worship is going to be given in the way that it should be. Now, with that said, what we understand is that there are some details concerning worship that are specific to either a group of people or an era in which they're living. So again, let's just look at a couple of examples of this. One of the universal things about worship is you are recognizing God as the God of salvation. But let's look at two different ways this has been done. When we talk about the people of Israel, they had the Passover. And so they were to take time to commemorate this event where God allowed their firstborn to be spared as he passed through the land of Egypt in that 10th plague. And so for an Israelite, every year they were to observe this Passover as a part of their remembrance. Yet, when we come to the era of Christianity, the Lord is going to say, as we discussed last week, I want you to remember my part in salvation. And the way you're going to do this is, as we just did, you're going to partake of the bread in remembrance of my body. You're going to take of the fruit of the vine in remembrance of the blood that was shed for this new covenant that made you my people. All right, well, that would have been a foreign concept to the people of Israel, right? Because they didn't know the completed story like we do. And so on the night that the Lord's Supper was first observed, we had the final Passover, followed immediately by the first Lord's Supper. And from that point on, the observance of the Passover no longer necessary. It had been fulfilled in Jesus. We think about that also concerning a priesthood. In the Old Testament, we read a lot in the books of Exodus and Leviticus about Israel having this priestly line that's going to come from the tribe of Levi. The Levites and the priests are instrumental in assisting the ordinary people in their worship. They're offering sacrifices. They're teaching the law. They had a really, really big part to play. Yet, when we come to the age of Christianity, what Peter is going to tell us is, you are all priests. You no longer need that Levitical priesthood, and you no longer need that high priest who once a year is going to go into the temple and offer atonement for you, because Jesus is the high priest who offers that atonement continually. Notice the change. Israel would have had no concept of Jesus being the high priest. They might have gotten a whiff of it in some of the prophecies, yet we understand that fully. And so what was once just this picture or this shadow of things to come, no longer necessary. We could even make the same point to a certain extent with prayer. Now, regardless of whether you're Israelite or whether you are a Christian, you pray to God. But there is a difference that we see for Christians. We understand the role of Jesus in that prayer. He taught that for us. He said in John chapter 14, I'm the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Whatever you ask in my name, I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. Now, it's fine for us to end our prayers in Jesus' name. I'll probably do that till the day I die. But this is a much bigger deal than that. He's saying, what I want you to understand is that it's through me you come to the Father. I'm the conduit to the Father. You are going to be able to approach the throne. Well, would an Israelite have understood that? Again, maybe just somewhat partially in prophecy. But yet we have that fuller picture. Okay? So, we got a precedent. It's always toward God, always to the glory of God, no matter when you live. Yet, in certain eras with specific people, there may be differences that God prescribes in worship. So let's take that idea, and now let's focus it down to worshiping God in song. And as we start this point, let's immediately interrupt ourselves. Okay? Before we go any further, we need to know something. Here's what we need to know. Very first hymn recorded in the Bible is found in Exodus chapter 15. The Song of the Sea, recounting the glory of God bringing the Egyptians down. The very last hymn we have recorded is in Revelation 15. The Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb is what's being sung. All of it dealing with God's deliverance. And so every hymn in between is going to praise God. It's going to cry out for and to praise His deliverance. Remember, that Song of the Sea is all about how God saved Israel. The Song of the Lamb is all about how Jesus saves us. So you've got, again, those things being universal. And they both taught other people about God and His saving power. Here you got the makings of a good hymn, right? This is what it's got to be about. If it's going to be a good hymn, that God is central, God delivers, and we're teaching some grand concept about God. Throughout the Bible, we're going to find those things being a constant. But what about the difference? And in particular, what about this concept of using some kind of instrument along with your singing? Is that a big deal? Well, let's see what the Old Testament has to say about it. Interestingly, when you read the Law of Moses, there is only one instrument that is specified. You go to the book of Numbers in chapter 10. Verse 10 says, on the day of your gladness also, and at your appointed feast, and at the beginnings of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings, and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am the Lord your God. Okay, only mention of any instrument in the Law of Moses. And what's unique about this is it appears it's not really even accompanying singing, is it? It's more like an announcement. In fact, as I was doing a little reading on this, one of the writers said, it's kind of like the church bells of the old days. When it was time to assemble, somebody went out and they rang the bell and the community would hear that and they would know it's time to start making your way in. And I think that's right, that the trumpet here is announcing the feast, the offerings are about to take place. And so what do we know about that trumpet? Well, we know that that trumpet was designed by God and it was prescribed by God. This was not something where the people said, you know what would be a great idea? If somebody would just blow a trumpet when this happened so we would all know when to come. So in that, it parts company from the church bell, doesn't it? Church bell was a way somebody said, this is how we alert everybody. Here, though, you've got this trumpet The instructions are given by God. It's not some Egyptian trumpet that they brought along with them. It's one that was crafted as God said and used as God stated it was to be used. We also find, as I mentioned, that it's not used with their singing. So then to say, well, the law of Moses teaches that using instruments with our singing is acceptable is not really a true statement. That though you had the trumpet sound, again, not in association with their singing. What about, though, all of these other instruments? Well, there are, for sure. But they are not going to be introduced until many, many years later. Book of Numbers, we've got Moses receiving the law, and then we're going to have the conquest of the land with Joshua. We're going to have the time period of the judges. We're going to have the reign of King Saul. Then King David comes in hundreds of years later. And there are going to be a number of instruments now that will be introduced. So let's just look at a couple of examples of that from the Chronicles account. It says, David also commanded, this is where the ark's coming into the city, the chiefs of the Levites to appoint their brothers as the singers who should play loudly on musical instruments, on harps and lyres and cymbals to raise sounds of joy. And later in 2 Chronicles, it says, the priests stood at their post, the Levites also with the instruments for music to the Lord that King David had made for giving thanks to the Lord, for His steadfast love endures forever. Whenever David offered praises by their ministry, opposite them the priests sounded trumpets, okay, hearkening back to the law, and all Israel stood. And yet you have here that David is also using harps and lyres and cymbals. Now if you open that up to a little bit bigger picture in the Old Testament, somewhere around 10 times, you're going to have this triplet of instruments being used. During the reign of David or after the reign of David, they're going to be discussed, always together, the harps, the lyres, the cymbals being used. So we find that. We also find that there was a specific group who was designated to play them. You had to have somebody who knew how to play the harp, somebody who knew how to play the lyre, and somebody who knew how to do the cymbal. Right? You had to have that. And it may very well have been that this was something that would have been received by the inspiration of God. That someone would have gotten this ability because you're dealing here with the special tribe. They are specifically assigned to play these instruments. And then, wherever it's noted, okay, wherever there's a designation about where this is taking place, it's always centering around Jerusalem. The ark coming into Jerusalem, the temple worship at Jerusalem, or later on when the new walls around Jerusalem are dedicated. So wherever we read and there is a geographic location with the use of these instruments, always in Jerusalem that's taking place. Okay, so with all these details, I hope there's a glaring question in your mind. We talk about all this. What should the glaring question be? Well, this is what it should be. Who gave David this authority? Is this something that David said, you know what? I think this would be a great idea. I wonder, would David do that so quickly after God striking Uzzah dead for something else David thought was a great idea? That he would so quickly jump back into this? Or even as he thought about wanting to build the temple and the prophet said, David, that's a great idea. And God says, you go back and tell David that's not a great idea. I'll let his son do it. I'll build him a house, but you're going to let your son build that temple. So, is this something that David decided on? Well, the answer to that is absolutely not. And it is very easily learned in the Bible where that authority came from. Years after David, there was a restoration in the fullest sense of the term, as we talked about last Sunday night, where something had ceased and was now starting back again. And that was worship at the temple. Good King Hezekiah had decided that he was going to restore worship at the temple. And this is what we find. He stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord, here we go, with cymbals, harps, and lyres, according to the commandment of David. Okay, so we're not quite there yet with authority. And of Gad, the king's seer, and of Nathan the prophet, we're still not quite there because Nathan had told David to do something about building the temple and then had to change it. But here's where we find the ultimate. For the commandment was from the Lord. Now, everybody with me with this? You see what's happening? Here we find the addition of instruments, yes, for sure. But it was by the commandment of God that that was coming in. And so the harps, the lyres, the cymbals, they're all going to be used. So I would suggest to you here, King Hezekiah was a primitivist, wasn't he? Isn't that exactly what we're talking about? That you are going back and in his case saying, what did a plain old king like me do in relation to proper worship at the temple? And so he looked back to what David, the man after God's own heart, had done, not of his own choice, but because this was something that was commanded from God. Now, we'll not get into this morning, but just by way of note, later on, many years later, Nehemiah is going to be a primitivist. Israel had gone into captivity. Judah had gone into captivity. God allows them to return back. And Nehemiah is rebuilding Jerusalem, and he and Ezra are working to reestablish worship. And we have a quote right back to David with the cymbals and the lyres and the harps that King David commanded. So both of these men are looking to David and the command that God gave him as their authority for worship. Again, not by their own choice, but because this was a command from God. Let's throw in one more passage here, and this being from the prophet Amos. Amos is bringing the wrath of God down on the people in his message here. And he says concerning those who are wealthy, woe to those who lie on beds of ivory and stretch themselves out on their couches and eat lambs from their flock and calves from the midst of the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp, and like David, invent for themselves instruments of music, who drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved by the ruin of Joseph. Therefore, they shall now be the first of those who go into exile, and the revelry of those who stretch themselves out shall pass away. There have been people who've come to this passage, and in their desire to disprove the use of instruments, will say, here it says, David invented those instruments. But we got to look a little deeper than that. Because that word invent means the work of a skilled workman. And that's normally how it's translated in other places. It'll be the same words that are used about Aholiab and his assistant who were inspired to build the tabernacle. Same words used here. They didn't do it by their own authority. God gave them the knowledge of what to do. And so Amos is saying, you know, David did this with instruments, but yet what do we know? We know that he did it by God's instructions. He created these things by God's instructions. The point Amos is making is the wicked are doing it for their own pleasures. So it's a contrast, not a comparison. It's a contrast. David used these things for the glory of God by God's instruction. The wicked, lying around on these beds of ivory, are using these things for their own comfort and pleasure. So what does all of this point out to us? It's showing us that if we ever get this idea that David just simply, out of his own imagination, creates all these things because he loved music and he liked playing the harp and he just invented it all, we are wrong on that. Hezekiah telling us this is by God's instruction. Now, let's take that a step further. When we lock all of this together, the text is saying the use of instruments in the time period of Israel was commanded and approved by God. The trumpet for calling, the harp, the lyre, the cymbal as a part of worship. We know that they were played by designated individuals. The text indicates to us the Levites were the ones who did that. Maybe inspired Levites, but we know for sure Levites. And where the place is indicated, it's always in Jerusalem with something about Jerusalem. The ark that's there, the temple that's there, or the walls that are being constructed. Now let's take all of that and let's now approach the question for us. Okay, so we're going to ask the primitivist question. If I'm looking to the Bible for my authority, here's my question. How did plain old Christians sing in praise to God? Well, the first thing I know is this. Okay? There may be a shadow back in the time of Israel, but can I use them as a model? Can I say that, okay, well, I read about the harp, the lyre, the cymbal, the trumpet, read about that from Numbers, read about that from what's said relating to David. Can I use that as my model? Well, what's my question? How did plain old Christians sing? Do we have an Ark of the Covenant? Do we have a temple in the sense that they did? Are we surrounded by walls as they did? We'd have to answer no to all those questions, wouldn't we? Very different situation. Worship, yes. But when and where that worship's being given, very different. We also realize there's no Levites. You know, we don't have a designated group of Levites this morning who is here to assist us in our worship. That's something that's gone as well. We do not have feast, right? Numbers 10, the trumpets were used to call people to the burnt offerings, to the feast associated with some of those things. None of that. So what are we seeing? We're seeing that these aren't plain old Christians, are they? And if we had any doubt, we need only read the book of Hebrews. And the book of Hebrews is going to say, you know, you got a much better high priest now, Jesus Christ. You've got a much better system. You've got a much better covenant. Things have made a major change from the time period that we looked at earlier. So if I'm a believer in this idea that I'm going to go back to the Bible, I'm going to look for people like me who are worshiping, and I'm going to try to mimic that, not finding a lot of similarities here with the people that we've been talking about this morning. So our conclusion then for this aspect would have to be, David is not a plain old Christian like me. Hezekiah is not a plain old Christian like me. Nehemiah is not. Were they saints? Yes. Were they good people? Yes. But different situation, different circumstances. Therefore, they are not going to be my authority from where I learn how to worship God. So the question then is, what does the New Testament teach? Well, we've already established that to a point. Whether we're David, Nehemiah, first century Christians, 21st century Christians, always directed toward God, always praising Him from the heart, helping others to praise Him also, those things are consistent. But what about our question of using instruments? What we find is outside of the book of Revelation, in the New Testament, there is zero mention of harps, lyres, and flutes that are being used. Or we could say harps and lyres and cymbals if we wanted to stay with the other language. We're not finding any word of that. Now, you go to the book of Revelation, and you've got a couple of mention of harps. So I have to ask, is this dealing with plain old Christians like me? Here are people who are already with God. And we also understand the language is very symbolic there. So to take that as our authority, we're going to have to pull in lots of things, right? Dragons and stars in the skies, lots of things like that. So we understand that's not language that's pertaining to plain old worship by plain old Christians like me. So from Matthew through Jude, not a word about that. So I got to explore that. Is there anything that's going to teach me about how I need to worship God in song? Well, Ephesians 5 is the rescue. Ephesians chapter 5 is the answer to that question. And I'm not going to take a long time to go through, but let me just give you a little bit of context. Here are two or three really big ideas we find. that the apostle is really getting to the crux of the book. And he's saying, here is Christ who's done all of this for you. You owe Him everything. He is your salvation. Now, what does that mean for you? It means you walk in love and not in sinfulness. It's all contrast here in this section of chapter 5. And Paul goes on and he says, you walk in the light, not in darkness. When you think about what God has done for you, you do what God desires. You get away from those things that are evil. And he says, you walk in wisdom and not foolishness. And then we reach a point in Paul's letter as he's telling them, you need to be wise people, that he says this, look, don't go out and be filled with liquor. Don't go out and be filled with this intoxicant. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. Okay, so another contrast. He's saying, don't be filled with liquor that's going to lead to these walks of darkness. You be filled with the Spirit. Now, a lot of shadows are going to start popping from the Old Testament. What do we read about in the Old Testament that was occasionally filled with the Spirit? Well, when we think about when the tabernacle was dedicated, when the Temple of Solomon was dedicated, we find that the Spirit of God fills it. It's like smoke. The glory of God comes in. What do we read in 1 Corinthians 3:16? You are a temple. You are a temple. Not one in Jerusalem now. Where the temple sat, it's an empty mountaintop as far as a structure goes like the Israelites were used to worshiping at. But yet God's saying now, that's not where you worship. You are a temple of God. And what does Paul add? He says, when you are walking in love, walking in light, walking in wisdom, you are filled with the Spirit. But he doesn't stop. He's going to go on and make the point from that of this, and I put this in good Southern so we can understand it. The implication is a group of people. Y'all are addressing one another now. He's saying, y'all are addressing each other in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody to the Lord with your heart. Who is? The people who are filled with the Spirit. Y'all, you Ephesians, you're filled with the Spirit. This is what you do now. You're not overflowing with drunkenness. Here's the overflow of the Spirit. Who are the singers? Well, that's the y'all. Or we could say that's the us. Are the Ephesians plain old Christians like us? Yeah. Doesn't seem to be anything special about this group. Anything special about the discussion here that would put them in a peculiar time or a peculiar instance? Doesn't seem to be the case. What's said about them could easily be said about us. So the singers then are imitators of Christ who are filled with the Spirit. Who's receiving it? Well, Paul says, one another. You're singing to one another. And in so doing, you're giving it to the Lord, just as we've done this morning. He gave us a song, right? We're telling Him that. We're telling each other that. Everything's leading to praise in God. So the receivers are one another, but most importantly, it's God. And we're told about the songs here. And I don't know that there's a lot of difference in these three categories. Psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, maybe a few nuances. But it's basically what we said earlier, directed toward God, praising God for salvation, showing Him the glory. So we've got all of our answers here about singing. But what about this? Now we might look at that verse and say, well, there is zero mention of an instrument. And we would be entirely wrong to say that. Because that term, making melody, is an instrumental term. The old definition, to pull, twitch, twang, will play. Old way of saying, it's like you're playing a harp or a lyre. That's the word that would be useful. So what is that instrument? I don't see a trumpet. I don't see a harp. I don't see a lyre. I don't see a flute. What I see is the instrument is your heart. That's what's being played. Y'all people who are filled with the Spirit, who are singing to the Lord and to one another, psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, with this instrument, as you twang on your heart. That's what you're playing to God. Now put this all together. And what do we find about plain old Christians? We're like little mobile temples. We don't have to go to the temple anymore. We are the temple. Here is where God is meeting with us. We are like the temple, Paul's going to tell us. And you're going to give temple worship, not Levites, you. You're speaking in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. And this is the instrument God says, I want you to use. I want you to use your hearts. No mention of a trumpet. No mention, as with David, being commanded to use those others. And what I want you to do is sing praise to me, and I want you to speak to one another. And when I look at it from a primitivist standpoint, the question is really not that hard to answer, is it? If I'm going to do it like plain old Christians in the New Testament did it, Paul has given me the full model for doing that. And so, I'm going to disagree that it's the height of arrogance and the depths of stupidity to believe this. Because what I'm doing in this is what I do in all kinds of communication. You're telling me something, does it apply to me? If it applies to me, what do I need to do? That's what we've looked at here. And so, what we want to remember for sure is this, though. It's never about proving some point like that being the end all. It's simply saying, I am so attuned to wanting to worship God the way He desires. I'm going to make sure that I exercise self-control and take self out of the picture so that I can look and see exactly what God is prescribing for me and to do it the way He desires. And of course, the biggest thing we've got to understand is we can leave every instrument off, but if we're not playing that instrument of our heart, it's still vain worship. God's saying, I want you fully connected in all this. I want you giving me worship that's going to honor and glorify me. Thank you for your good attention this morning. We're going to give an opportunity now for any who might like to become a Christian. This lesson hasn't really dealt with those kinds of things other than to say, it's all about praising God, isn't it? And when we dedicate our lives to God, what we're saying is, I'm going to give it all over to you. As Paul would say, I'm dead and Christ is living in me. If you're ready to make that commitment this morning, by God's grace, you can be buried in the waters of baptism for the forgiveness of your sins, just like plain old Christians did on the day of Pentecost, just like plain old Christians did in the book of Acts, whether you were male or female or Jew or Gentile or pagan or rich or poor or whatever. It's going to add us to the body of Jesus Christ, and we'll be raised up to His glory. Praise Him not only in our worship, but also in our actions, so that one day we can be with God in that perfect state of worship that will never end. If you're ready to make that response to Him this morning, the opportunity is available while we stand and sing together.